A group of 15 rights groups urge the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden to address the deterioration of human rights in Bahrain. The group, which includes the Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy and Amnesty International, wrote in a letter to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken that Bahrain's rulers were emboldened by President Trump, sending a clear message that his administration would place the pursuit of profit before people. Back in 2017, Trump said there won't be strain with this administration when it comes to U.S.-Bahrain ties. Under Trump, Manama secured over $8.5 billion in arms deals. Bahrain has engaged in a widespread crackdown on opposition groups and human rights activists since 2011, when the country's rulers faced nationwide pro-democracy protests calling for the removal of the Al Khalifa regime.
More than a dozen rights groups have urged the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden to restrict arms sales to Bahrain and address, quote, severe deterioration of human rights under the Al Khalifa regime. A letter signed by 15 groups, including the Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy, Amnesty International, and the World Organization Against Torture, has been sent to the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. The letter calls on Washington to pressure Manama over a ban on opposition political parties and independent media, and demand an end to the suppression of activists, the use of torture, and other ill treatment. It also urges the Biden administration to adopt a rights-based foreign policy toward Bahrain. The Bahraini regime has been cracking down on dissent since 2011 popular uprising against the Al Khalifa dynasty. Amid deafening silence of the then U.S. administration under Barack Obama and his successor Donald Trump, the kingdom went on with its heavy-handed tactic, killing and arresting activists and opposition figures. A recent report by a London-based Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy shows at least 51 people have been sentenced to death since 2011 in the tiny Persian Gulf island. Rights groups say Trump's public disdain for international human rights emboldened the Al Khalifa regime. They say Trump even sold $8.5 million worth of arms to Bahrain. The signatories of the letter have urged Biden to live up to his campaign promises of fighting for democracy and pressure Bahrain to introduce democratic reforms. The letter comes as the Biden administration is facing criticism for failing to hold Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman accountable for his role in the gruesome murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. That after a declassified U.S. intelligence report publicly accused bin Salman of approving Khashoggi's assassination in the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul in 2018. Washington's failure to take practical steps to bring bin Salman to justice once again exposes double standards in dealing with the criminals and rights abusers and its support for dictators. It also proved that the Biden administration's policies differ from those of Trump's only in rhetoric, not in essence. Ironically, such stance under regimes like Saudi Arabia or Bahrain would simply embolden them to carry on their grave violations of human rights at home and beyond their borders.
Joining us on this debate, we have former British ambassador to Bahrain, Mr. Peter Ford, joining us from Manchester. Also joining us on the line from London, we have Mr. Masoud Shajara from the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Ford in Manchester. A group of 15 rights bodies has urged the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden to address the deterioration of human rights in Bahrain. A part of the letter said that we hope that your administration will ensure that human rights are once again placed at the center of U.S. foreign policy in Bahrain, also calling for that in the wider Persian Gulf region. Share with us your thoughts on that letter.
Well, the initiative is well timed. It was just this week, a couple of days ago, that Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, made an important speech proclaiming that under Biden, America was going to be keen once more on spreading democracy and supporting human rights. Biden himself signed off on an important strategy document underlining that commitment. And here we have these 15 groups calling for America to put its money where its mouth is with regards to Bahrain, where the human rights situation is truly appalling, going from bad to worse.
Mr. Shajadeh, in London, the group wrote in the letter addressed to the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, that you noted that in too many countries, people are imprisoned and face torture or death for speaking their minds, reporting the news, or demanding their rights. This statement sadly reflects the situation in Bahrain over the last 4 years. Mr. Shajadeh, I think it's safe to say that it's not just the last 4 years in Bahrain, and it's not just in Bahrain, is it?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, we are. There is one thing: articulation of supporting human rights and justice and democracy. We have heard this from the variety of administration from the United States, but in practice and in reality, definitely in the region of Middle East, and not just Middle East, you're seeing exactly opposite that. You know, we're seeing that dictators are being encouraged to continue their dictatorship and encouraged to implement these policies of barbaric policies of torture, imprisonment, and indeed they are continuously being supported. And there is some people complain that this is double standard. But when you look at the whole history and the recent history, be it Obama's administration or Trump's administration or indeed the current administration, we are seeing this same situation. So it's not a double standard. Unfortunately, it's a one standard, which it's sort of legitimized hypocrisy and abuse and torture. You know, we just look at the Bahrainis cannot implement these policies without help and support directly from the West and United States. Even, you know, their torturers and the police and their army are being organized and sort of supported by indeed Americans and British ex-police officers, MI5 officers, etc., etc. So really, I think it is very honorable for people to ask that, and it's the right thing to ask for, but I think we shouldn't be holding our breath.
Mr. Ford, under former President Trump, Bahrain secured over $8.5 billion in arms deals. The group of rights bodies said Bahrain's rulers were emboldened by President Trump, sending a clear message that his administration will place the pursuit of profit before people. Will it be any different now? Because that specific U.S. policy of having profit over people, it hardly ever changes.
Bahrain has taken out an insurance policy in the shape of normalizing relations with Israel. They know very well that the way to America's heart is through Israel, and that is precisely where they have gone. Last year, they moved quickly towards normalization, and every month almost brings a new development. Very recently, Crown Prince Salman invited Mr. Netanyahu to visit Bahrain. So just in case the arms purchases aren't enough to guarantee an American blind eye to human rights abuse, the Bahrainis have gone very deeply into a new relationship with Israel, including a security and intelligence relationship. They even have Israeli companies providing spyware to use against Bahraini citizens.
Mr. Shajadeh, our guest in Manchester, he just mentioned the issue of Israel. As we know, Bahrain was among Arab nations that signed normalization agreements with the Israeli regime in 2020 during the Trump administration. Will Washington now want to get harsh with Manama after they've cozied up to the Israeli regime, surely agreeing to reap its benefits from Washington as well?
And absolutely. I mean, I have to point out that this cozy relationship has not been just come after so-called normalization. This has been going on for a very long time. All we saw it was the sort of public acknowledgement of this relationship. And indeed, I have to say that, you know, I agree with the other participants that it's not about the money. I mean, the amount of money that is being coming in through Bahrain or even Saudi Arabia, in the proportion to our GDP, in proportion of our export overall, it's really much less than even 0.something%. And so really that is not something that's breaking the deal. They're breaking the deal because they are actually doing the bidding of the United States and Israel, and they are oppressing their own people, they're torturing their own people, they're undermining their legitimate needs and aspiration. And as long as they are going to be sort of the agents of United States and Israel and so forth, and supporting and providing what they need to be provided in the region, it's very clear that they are being given ability and the right to go and kill and torture their own people. And this is what is so sad. And, you know, this policy was the policy which was implemented elsewhere in the world. And this is a very short-sighted policy of trying to buy favor with the nation. Because eventually people of Bahrain, like others, are going to sort of hold their leaders accountable. And then they're going to have a different view vis-a-vis United States or Israel and the West as a whole, who have been instrumental in the sort of denying them the empowerment of deciding their own future.
Mr. Ford, you mentioned the Bahrainis. They do have a sense of security right now by normalizing ties with Israel. There's another side to that security card as well, having in mind that Bahrain is home to the U.S.'s 5th Fleet. Do you think that regionally it's too far-fetched even to expect any major change in approach towards Manama, no matter who the president is?
I'm not at all optimistic for the reason you just cited, the presence of an important base for the Gulf base for the U.S. 5th Fleet. Bahrain for many years has been strategically important to the United States. Going forward, the U.S. strategists may realize that having ships so close to the Iranian coast is not really a good strategy, and what they consider assets are in fact liabilities, so that Manama could turn out to be a bit like Pearl Harbor if things got really, really bad. It's noteworthy that when things got very hot with Iran 18 months ago in the Gulf, the main U.S. Ships were withdrawn from the Gulf and parked 1,000 miles away. So the usefulness of that Bahraini base may have a sell-by date on it, but certainly for the duration of the Biden presidency, I'm afraid that consideration will weigh heavily with the Americans, and I don't expect the slightest real pressure to be put on Bahrain.
Mr. Shajara, the protests in Bahrain in 2011, they came amid similar uprisings in the region. There was Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, Yemen. The U.S. and company, they went on to pick and choose who they supported and who they didn't. Back then, it was the Obama administration in office. Joe Biden was the vice president. That inconsistency and hypocrisy on the issue of human rights, it was even evident back then as well.
Absolutely. I think it really is extremely bad policy which United States is pursuing. As my colleague said, that it really is the the base is a liability. And I would say that even sort of these normalization and this sort of treatment of you know, being obedient servants of interests of the West and then oppressing your own people, it actually brings insecurity long term. If Bahrain indeed moved towards democracy at that time, when there was the sort of Arab Spring, or it would have actually ensured much more secure position. And the oppositions weren't asking for anything extreme. The opposition were extremely well organized. It wasn't like the situation that we have seen in Libya, where you know, the whole country was went into the turmoil. I really think that now what we could see, indeed, because of this policy that is being pursued by the United States with the support of Israel and some other region, regional countries, indeed is going to bring instability. You can't sort of create a conflict or promote a conflict with Iran and certain parts of a region without bringing insecurity and instability to the whole region.
One last question for Mr. Ford. We have about 30 seconds left. Why has, in your opinion, the mainstream media kept silent on all that has happened in Bahrain? The crackdowns, the arrests, the death sentences, the stripping of citizenships. Very briefly, if you may.
Well, it's inconvenient and therefore is ignored. The mainstream media would much rather talk about Syria, for example, where, with regards to human rights, the situation is certainly no worse than it is in Bahrain. But Bahrain doesn't fit the narrative. No pressure is going to be put on Bahrain, and therefore Bahrain can get away with almost anything, which is tragic, because the people of Bahrain are very civilized, very sophisticated, and represent no threat to stability if they are allowed to say in.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Former British ambassador to Bahrain, Mr. Peter Ford, joining us from Manchester. Also, thanks to Masoud Shajareh from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, joining us from London. Also, special thanks to you all for staying with us on this debate. It's good night for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
قَدْ أَفْلَحَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ.
Certainly will the believers have succeeded.
الَّذِينَ هُمْ فِي صَلَاتِهِمْ خَاشِعُونَ.
They who are during their prayer humbly submissive.
وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ عَنِ اللَّغْوِ مُعْرِضُونَ.
And they who turn away from ill speech.
Before we get into details talking about the different verses of this surah, I assume knowing the different sections and different parts of this chapter and the virtues stated in this surah will help us a lot in achieving the true meanings of the different verses. As you may know, this chapter was revealed in Mecca. It is the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, and it has got 118 verses. With regard to the virtues stated about this surah, there are so many recorded narrations quoted from the Prophet ﷺ and the Imams regarding this. On the virtue of reciting this surah, Imam Sadiq ﷺ has said, "Frequent recitation of this surah, especially on Fridays, brings bliss in this world and hereafter, and it also leads to the enjoyment of the company of the divine prophets in the lofty paradise." In this regard, also, there is a tradition from the Prophet ﷺ, and in that tradition we read, "On the day of hereafter, the angels will give whoever recites Surah Al-Mu'minun good tidings about the breath of life and a garden of delight, and when the angel of death comes to take his soul, he will give him such good tidings that he will be delighted." Mentioning the virtues of reciting the chapters of the Holy Quran never means reading them without pondering over them, without practicing them actually, because this heavenly book is a book with practical programs for the training and education of all the people. So if someone harmonizes his practical and doctrinal programs with the content of this surah, or even with the few of the verses which are found at the beginning of it, that refers to the attributes of the believers on the Day of Judgment, hopefully all these glories will certainly be granted to him.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
In some Islamic narrations, we read that when the first verses of this surah were revealed, the Prophet ﷺ said, 10 verses have been revealed to me, that whoever puts them into practice will enter paradise. And when the Prophet said these words, he used the Arabic word aqama, which means put into practice, instead of the word qara'a. And this is referring to the same fact we mentioned, that the aim should be practicing and also pondering upon the contents of this surah. The main aim is not only bare reading, but applying the meaning of these verses to everyday life. Now, as the name of this surah suggests, its content is mostly about the special attributes of the believers. And at the end, the chapter mentions some statements upon the beliefs and practice that complete these attributes. The contents of this surah can be divided into 7 parts. In the first part, where it says, قَدْ أَفْلَحَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ, successful indeed are the believers, this surah mentions the attributes that lead to the salvation and deliverance of the believers. These practical attributes are so comprehensive and accurate that they also cover various aspects of social and personal life. So, beginning with the noble verse, successful indeed are the believers, the holy chapter continues, since the essence of the believers is totally belief and monotheism. The next verses continue to mention the different signs of knowing Allah, knowing His signs in the world of existence. The next verses recount some examples of the wonderful systems of the world of creation, such as the sky, the earth, the creation of man himself, and also the plants and some animals. We will, inshallah, talk about the remaining parts of the contents of this chapter in the next program. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry ends when fate begins.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the World with Reporters.
$1.7 billion was pledged in the latest UN Donor Conference for Yemen, which is less than half of what was targeted. The United Nations described the pledges as disappointing. Yemeni people say they don't want the UN to continue begging for aid, but rather they want the Saudi-led war to be ended and the blockade lifted.
We said that we do not need any humanitarian support. They only have to stop the war and leave the siege on Yemen. And the Yemenis with their capabilities and resources can obtain their basic needs. Yet this conference came to glorify the countries participating in the war on Yemen and present them as a country supporting humanitarian work.
Human rights activists say the UN seeks to fulfill its programs through such campaigns, since what reaches the people in need is much less than what it spends as operational expenses for its local organizations.
The donors' conference is an attempt to cover the UN failure in managing humanitarian aid that has caused an increase in the need as well as the money that is gained. It's not aimed at covering the real need in Yemen, but rather to ensure the continuity of the work of the UN organizations, where about 70% of these insufficient funds are spent as operational expenses for organizations' programs.
According to the United Nations, Yemenis are experiencing the world's worst humanitarian crisis since the beginning of 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a devastating war on the impoverished country.
Yemenis say the UN campaigns and initiatives are useless unless they are associated with real steps to stop the ongoing war and the blockade on Yemen that have led to the death of tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children, and are still going on. عبد اللطيف الوشلي صنع.
Britain, France and Germany drop a resolution against Iran at the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors. Iran's ambassador to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, said most board members agreed that now is not the time for a resolution criticizing Iran's cooperation with the agency. Tehran had warned the three European states the adoption of such a resolution would be interpreted as an end to the joint understanding between Iran and the IAEA reached more than a week ago, allowing the agency to continue with necessary verification work in the country. Gharibabadi said the E3 exercised a prudent approach by considering the consequences of their proposal.
We welcome such an approach by the Board of Governors and also the E3 countries, and it shows that the wisdom prevails, actually. And in my view, by stopping the process of pursuing this resolution, an unnecessary tension was prevented.
IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi said Tehran had accepted his initiative to engage in a focused, systematic effort to clarify a number of outstanding issues.
We were able to have an understanding, and we are going to be starting this process of focused analysis of the situation with a technical meeting, which will take place in Iran the beginning of April, which I hope will be followed by other technical or political meetings as agreed by both sides.
Grossi said his intention is to come to a satisfactory outcome in time for the next regular session of the board next June. The agency says it wants to clarify questions concerning the presence of uranium particles at undeclared locations in Iran. Iran has already provided the agency with complimentary access to three locations. Iran's ambassador to the IAEA says Tehran is also determined to resolve the remaining issues, although it does not believe in setting artificial deadlines. Homalezgi, Vienna.
Preliminary data released by the National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, shows that absolute poverty levels in Italy reached a 15-year high in 2020, Last year, the number of families facing absolute poverty climbed to 7.7% from 6.4% in 2019, translating into more than 2 million households not being able to afford the minimum standards of living, which include food, adequate shelter, and health care.
We had more than 1 million additional poor in 2020 compared to the year before. However, it must be said that growing poverty levels have also been recorded across all European countries and in the UK after the 2008 financial crisis. Italy has struggled to pick up from that downturn due to a fragmentation of anti-poverty policies and ineffective employment strategies.
Statistical body Istat also stressed that the monthly spending of the average Italian household dropped by almost 10%. Sent to about 2,300 euros last year, the lowest value since 2000.
Those without solid job contracts are the most exposed in the COVID-19 crisis that has already killed almost 100,000 people in Italy, the second highest death toll in Europe. Food security is emerging as a key issue for an increasing number of Italians.
The cost of living has risen to unbearable levels. My son used to work as a temporary employee in a restaurant. He has been jobless for months now. How long can we carry on this way?
The previous government hasn't helped Italy much. My daughter has been temporarily laid off, and her pay is now one-third of what it used to be.
Discontent among Italians is also growing over a much delayed vaccination campaign. So far, 1.5 million people, about 3% of the population only, have been inoculated with both COVID vaccine doses amid delays and disputes in the delivery schedule across the whole of the European Union. Max Civili, Rome.
Presidents of 17 universities from 10 member states of the Economic Cooperation Organization attended the online session to exchange views on ways to expand scientific cooperation. Hosted by Iran's Allama Tabatabai University, the event was attended by university heads from Pakistan, Turkey, Kazakhstan, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Uzbekistan.
I would like to express my gratitude for the invitation to such an important event. At the Kyrgyz-Russian Slavic University, there are 9,000 students, 7 faculties and 92 departments. Out of this number, over 1,600 are international students coming from 19 countries, including from ECO member states.
We have a lot of potential. We have a lot of opportunities to collaborate with each other. How we can collaborate? There is a faculty exchange program. We can collaborate in terms of faculty exchange, in terms of student exchange.
Allama Tabatabai University, which hosted the session, was founded in 1984 with two departments of literature and humanities and administrative and commercial sciences. The ATU then expanded its academic activities by launching more departments, such as Persian literature and foreign languages, social sciences, economics, accounting and management, psychology and educational sciences, and health and basic sciences. Its incumbent president, Hossein Salimi, says the ATU has enormous potential for cooperation with other ECO member states.
We will start with exchanging professors and students and cooperation in research projects and common educational and major project, and I think that we can start with some workshops and some seminars between universities.
Launched in 1985 by Iran, Pakistan and Turkey with the purpose of promoting economic and technical cooperation, the ECO is an intergovernmental organization which encompasses countries from Europe and Asia, covering a population of 460 million people. The overall objective of the organization is to promote sustainable economic development of its member states and the region. Currently, the regional organization has 10 member states, including Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Azerbaijan.
The ECO was established as a network that connects the economies of the member states. However, delegates here say it can act as more than just an economic link, but as a platform for scientific and technological exchanges. They say today's session was a promising start to that end. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
COVID-19 has compounded a problem that was already prevalent in the 27-nation European Union. Poverty affects a quarter of the bloc's citizens in one form or another. The so-called European Pillar of Social Rights Action Plan has just been presented.
Our first aim is to combat child poverty. Too many children in Europe are exposed to the risk of poverty.
A key element of the European Commission's plan is to modernise the EU's education systems. The aim is to lift 15 million people in the EU out of poverty by 2030. Similar targets were missed in the past.
I think the European Commission has been putting forward some interesting proposal to reduce unemployment, but I don't think it goes far enough. I think more needs to be done really to put job creation at the heart of the policy process.
The coronavirus has led to a surge in mental health issues in the EU due to lockdowns and rising unemployment, but unions say the psychological impact is also hitting those still in work. Calls are being made on the European Commission to develop a strategy to deal with post-traumatic stress disorder that could affect many of the bloc's 14.7 million frontline health workers, particularly those who have been administering care in the coronavirus hotspots. Experts say the EU's slow vaccination rollout is allowing mutations of the virus to spread. The European Commission has been asked to respond.
These new variants, where we definitely need to adapt, adjust, prepare and front-load many of the efforts we had planned.
At this point, it's impossible to say precisely how many people in the EU have been vaccinated.
I have called on member states to increase information on sharing on national vaccination rollout plans and share this data.
The European Commission has announced it will present plans focusing on the easing of COVID-19 restrictions on the 17th of this month. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Jubilations among ranks and files of the opposition parties after the Senate elections in Pakistan. The combined opposition parties have managed to retain its majority in 100-member Senate. The Senate elections were held against 37 seats and the ruling party of Prime Minister Imran Khan won 25 seats. Khan's party emerged as the single largest political force in the Senate for the first time. Nonetheless, Khan's party, together with its allies, is still short of 6 senators to gain majority in the Senate. Under the proportionate election systems, 4 provincial parliaments, together with the national parliament, elect 100-member Senate. After every 3 years, half of the senators retire and regional and federal parliaments elect remaining members of the upper house of the parliament through secret balloting. Despite emerging as the single largest political force in the Senate elections, Khan's party suffered a major setback when the 342-member lower house of the parliament elected opposition candidate Yousaf Rza Gilani as the senator. Gilani is also the former prime minister of Pakistan. With the election of Gilani, the opposition is now eyeing at dislodging the prime minister. The opposition says Khan has lost majority in the National Assembly, which had elected him prime minister in 2018.
Imran Khan ko istifa dena chahiye.
Now Prime Minister Imran Khan must resign. It is not only a demand by the opposition, but Senate pattern indicates that it is also demand of members of the ruling party.
Aapka kya?
Opposition candidate won the elections amid a video scandal on mainstream media showing agent of opposition offering tens of millions of dollars to win over MPs of the ruling party.
Opposition must feel ashamed of what they are talking about. The video shows selling votes to the opposition, which back up our stance against corruption.
Under pressure from the opposition parties, the government has announced that Prime Minister Imran Khan would soon take a fresh vote of confidence from the National Assembly. Analysts say that Khan is likely to retain his majority in the lower house of the parliament. Javed Rana, Islamabad. ¶¶
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015, hoping to bring former President Abdul Rabbu Mansur Hadi, who had resigned and fled the country, back to power. But with nearly 6 years into the war, Saudi Arabia has achieved none of its goals, and the war has left no choice for Yemenis but to resist. In the latest development, the Yemeni army launched a missile attack against an Aramco oil facility in Saudi Arabia's Jeddah on Thursday. The army also said it had successfully hit the King Khalid airbase in the kingdom's Asir province using drones. The attacks come in reaction to Saudi Arabia's ongoing war, despite Washington's pledge to end it. U.S. President Joe Biden ordered to halt arms sales to the kingdom to stop them being used in Yemen. However, Biden pledged to continue supporting Riyadh to defend its sovereignty. Analysts say the U.S. continues to transfer arms to Saudi Arabia under the pretext of selling defensive weapons.
When Joe Biden stated that he was not going to sell offensive missiles and weaponry to Saudi Arabia, that is what we call gobbledygook, because a weapon can be both defensive and offensive.
Besides, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson defended his country's continued arms sales to Saudi Arabia. He also stood by his government's decision to cut aid to war-torn Yemen by half, citing economic strains from the coronavirus pandemic. Yemen says the humanitarian situation resulted from the Saudi blockade has even become worse after Biden took office.
Actually, since Biden has took office, Saudi has blocked all ships that coming from Hodeidah, especially oil tanker. And this is actually has not happened during Trump administration.
The UN had appealed for $3.85 billion to fund urgently needed humanitarian programs in Yemen, but only $1.7 billion was offered at this year's donor conference. The UN described the pledges as disappointing and stressed that cutting aid would mean a death sentence for Yemeni people. Yemen relies on imports that have been badly disrupted over the years by the Saudi-led war and blockade. According to the World Body, the war on Yemen has created the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. A recent report showed some 16 million Yemenis, or more than half the population, is going hungry. Of those, 5 million are on the brink of famine. The UN stressed that the only solution to end the crisis in Yemen is ceasefire and a political solution. But considering the current stance by the West toward Yemen, it seems the U.S. and its allies do not want the war to stop anytime soon.
In a press conference held in Yemeni capital of Sana'a, the country's Ministry of Water and Environment elaborated on the damage inflicted to the water resources and infrastructure due to the Saudi-led invasion since 2015. The ministry said the war has impacted the sector severely, depriving thousands of Yemenis of access to drinking water. Officials said the war and siege imposed on the country have heavily affected the water supplies and forced millions to use unhealthy ways to store water. However, they say the severe fuel crisis has a major role in water shortage.
The per capita daily share of water consumption has dropped to 35 liters, and the lack of fuel will cause further decline and make matters worse. Water treatment and sanitation are also directly linked to fuel, so lack of fuel and the interruption in these processes may cause epidemics and endanger millions of lives.
Water resources and infrastructure are among the vital sectors that have been targeted by the Saudi-imposed war on Yemen. The war has left millions of Yemeni people without access to food and water, causing what the United Nations has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Thousands of Yemenis, including women and children, died of cholera during the 6 years of war. However, the Yemeni struggle to reach clean drinking water continues. The coronavirus pandemic has also worsened the situation in a country where more than 80% of people are in need of humanitarian assistance and support. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Israeli regime approved the building of 930 settlement units in the illegal settlement of Beth Gazaev in the heart of occupied Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Anti-settlement groups said the new units will be established on land seized from the villages of Beit Hanina, Hizma and Anata, northeast Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Israeli media quoted the Israeli mayor of Al-Quds, Moshe Lion, saying the new units are part of a plan amounting to 400 million shekels, around $122 million, to expand and support the settlements of Ramat Shlomo, Gilo and Givat Hamatis, north and south the city.
This is targeting the Palestinian communities inside Jerusalem, Beit Hanina, Anata and Hizma. It's a neighborhood, Palestinian neighborhood in East Jerusalem. And building the settlements in there, like in Beit Hanina, for example, they are expanding the settlement in Beit Hanina there. It doesn't leave any room for the Palestinian community there to expand anymore. Just need block it, either from the south by this block of settlement, from the north by a highway, a bypass road that they are doing.
In addition to its attempts to expand settlements in the Holy City and establish highways to link between the settlements inside Al-Quds and settlements outside it, Israel demolishes Palestinian homes under the claim they are built without Israeli issued permits. Experts say Tel Aviv continues to establish more facts on the ground designed toward a greater Jewish majority in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, aiming to create a new reality that makes realizing the two-state solution and Palestine's sovereignty over the city impossible.
What goes on in Jerusalem Al-Quds amounts to silent eviction of the Palestinians. Israel plans to Judaize the city and conduct ethnic cleansing against the Palestinians. It aims to impose new identity on the city.
Palestinian officials had warned several days ago that Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was planning to build thousands of settlement units for Orthodox Jews to encourage unity among religious Zionist parties before the Israeli elections that are set for March 23, especially that Netanyahu has no clear path to staying in power. Some might argue that Trump's so-called deal of the century is dead, but the reality on the ground is different, as Israel continuously approves construction of new settlements on occupied Palestinian territory. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
The Limelight. Texas said on Tuesday, 2nd of March, that it was lifting its mask requirement and would allow businesses to fully reopen, the most expansive step by any U.S. state to remove coronavirus restrictions, and Americans across the country are eager to emerge after a year of isolation in the coronavirus pandemic. The move by Texas, with its 29 million residents, goes further than similar actions by other states and cities that are rushing to ease as many limits as they can. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Julie Bossman and Lucy Tompkins. The piece is titled, "Texas Drops Its Virus Restrictions as a Wave of Reopenings Takes Hold." Texas said on Tuesday, 2nd of March, that it was lifting its mask requirement and would allow businesses to fully reopen, the most expansive step by any U.S. state to remove coronavirus restrictions, as Americans across the country are eager to emerge after a year of isolation. The move by Texas, with its 29 million residents, goes further than similar actions in other states and cities that are rushing to ease as many limits as they can. "It is now time to open Texas 100%, Texas Governor Greg Abbott said, adding that COVID has not suddenly disappeared, but state mandates are no longer needed. All around the country, governors and mayors are celebrating what is feasible, what is safe, and what is politically practical. In Chicago, Illinois, tens of thousands of children returned to public school this week, while snow-covered parks and playgrounds around the city that have been shuttered since last March were opened up again. Mississippi ended its mask mandate too. Restaurants in Massachusetts were allowed to operate without capacity limits, and South Carolina erased its limit on large gatherings. San Francisco, California announced that indoor dining, museums, movie theaters, and gymnasiums could reopen on a limited basis. But federal health officials have worried that state and local leaders may be moving too fast. "I know people are tired. They want to get back to life, to normal," Dr. Rochelle Walensky, director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, said on Monday. But we're not there yet. The divergent guidance has left many Americans in a quandary, wondering whether to follow the lure of optimism as some officials in California, Michigan, and North Carolina endorse widespread reopenings of businesses and schools, or to heed their own lingering concerns about the coronavirus and the warnings of federal health officials who have said it is premature to lift too many limits. As Kitty Sherry, a 36-year-old, sent her son Jude off to his Chicago elementary school this week for the first time in nearly a year, she felt caught in a middle ground between elation and worry. "There's a part of me that's really excited that he's back in school," Kitty Sherry said. But she said she worried about the health risk to teachers and said her family was still avoiding restaurants and other indoor spaces because of the coronavirus pandemic. "It's not over yet," she said, "so there's not too much celebration." Government officials have sent mixed signals, often cautious messages, to the public. Dr. Anthony Fauci, President Joe Biden's chief medical advisor for COVID-19, said this week that for small groups of people who have all been fully vaccinated, there was low risk in gathering together at home. Activities beyond that, he said, would depend on data, modeling, and good clinical common sense, adding that the Center for Disease Control, CDC, would soon have guidance for what vaccinated people could do safely. The message that many Americans are hearing from their elected officials, including leaders from both political parties, is upbeat. Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan said on Tuesday that she was easing restrictions on businesses and allowing family members who have tested negative for the coronavirus to visit nursing home residents. Governor Charlie Baker of Massachusetts said that while residents should continue to wear face masks in public, it was time for more limits on businesses to be eased. In Kentucky, all but a handful of school districts are now offering in-person classes, while the state races to vaccinate teachers as quickly as possible. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear told reporters last week that the state's falling infection statistics showed that immunizations were beginning to make an impact. "It means vaccinations work," he said. "We're already seeing it. We're seeing it in these numbers. It's really a positive sign." In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott's lifting of limits goes into effect on 10th of March. Some Democrats sharply criticized the idea, saying it suggests a more optimistic picture of the state's progress with the coronavirus than the reality. There are reasons for optimism. Vaccinations have increased significantly in recent weeks, and daily reports of new coronavirus cases have fallen across the country from their January peaks. The positive signs come with caveats, though. Though national statistics have improved drastically since January, they have plateaued in the last week or so, and the United States is still reporting more than 65,000 new cases a day on average, comparable to the peak of last summer's surge, according to a New York Times database. The country is averaging more than 2,000 deaths per day. though deaths are a lagging indicator because it can take weeks after being infected with the coronavirus to die from it.